Post, P-O-S-T, P-O-S-T, the cereals you like the most. The cereals made by Post take you to the secret mountain retreat of Captain Video, electronic wizard, master of time and space, guardian of the safety of the world. Fighting for law and order, Captain Video operates from a mountain retreat with secret agents all over the globe. Possessing scientific secrets and weapons, Captain Video asks no quarter and gives none to the forces of evil. Stand by for Captain Video and his Video Rangers. Brought to you today by Post's Raisin Bran, the fruit and cereal treat. Crisp flakes plus tender raisins. The raisins add flavor to the flakes, and the flakes add flavor to the raisins. Post's Raisin Bran.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Stop it!
Genesis! What's in the box?
Disenfranchised by the modern comics industry, producer Paul Spataro, Dr. Bill Robinson, and Scott H. Gardner now
ply the time stream in a never-ending quest to rediscover and reconnect with that unique brand of fun and excitement that can only truly be found in good old-fashioned, randomly selected comic book back issues. Journey with them now. Back to the bins.
I got nowhere else to go! I got nowhere else to go! I got nothing else.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am joined once again by my very good buddy, Mr. Scott Gardner.
Hello! Thank you for having me.
Am I really having you? I mean, let's be realistic. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Just want to mention that Dr. Bill Robinson and David A. Pasquarello are on assignment, and by on assignment, I mean sleeping in late. So, yeah, that's why they're not with us for this episode. So.
And, I think the term, the scientific term, I'm pretty sure is lazy shit.
Yes. Yes. We need to continue to give them grief and podcast shame them until they're back on the air like they should be.
Anyway, I wanted to take a couple of minutes to talk before we get started. Today we are doing a traditional Back to the Bins episode with two truly random books, which is a lot of fun, and that's how the show started. And we've kind of morphed and changed and moved around, and I wanted to touch base. We're having a lot of fun doing different things. The Legends of the Legion of Superheroes, Scott and Dave doing the Origins episodes.
Justice Society.
Justice Society, whatever, Justice something. Dave and I are trying to do Commandy. I'm doing Camelot 3000 with Gene Hendricks, and Bill and I do the Avengers Spotlight episode. So we're doing a lot of little side projects. And speaking of side projects, I wanted to say I think Scott and I have concluded our Thing Hulk retrospective, because in looking at the issues that came after the ones we've covered, we didn't see anything that we really felt compelled or passionate about talking about, and we didn't want to just do it for the sake of completeness. We wanted to do it because we were excited about it. So if anybody thinks there's an issue that we didn't cover that they say, no, this is one you really should look at, point it out to us. I'd be interested in knowing it.
Yeah, definitely. I would still like to do a wrap-up episode. I mean, not necessarily covering a book if there's not one to cover, but just one as kind of a retrospective, a final tally, if you will, that sort of thing. Because I really enjoyed that series, and I felt bad when I messaged you like, I think we're done with this. But it was just, as you say, I did read the next two books that we were supposed to cover, that we said we were going to cover, and they're not really Hulk thing tussles. I mean, not in the traditional sense that as we were covering them. and just really not worth the listener's time, frankly. So that's why I said I think we're kind of done. And then from there, I know at least one of them and possibly several of them were actually then retcon fights, you know, like taking place earlier in their timeline type of thing, which I was like, I mean, they could be great. I don't know, but it just seemed kind of weird. So, yeah, I was happy with where we were. I think we did a great job, and we kind of covered our mandated era, if you know what I mean. So.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun doing it. It's not, I don't want to make it sound like it was a chore. Now, from that, I wanted to go off a little bit to just discuss the fact that we've kind of let the email just kind of go.
Die.
I'll be honest with you, I had to look to try and find where the password was. I didn't even have it handy, and I wasn't able to find it. But then I know where it is, and I can find it. But to be honest with you, I think we may be done kind of emailing episodes or doing email episodes. But we are still interested in feedback from the listeners. So I really want to direct you to the Facebook page for Back to the Bins. I think that is your best place to just kind of give opinions, give thoughts, give topics that you're interested in, give suggestions. You can always PM either Scott or myself, and you know, we certainly would at least consider anything that you present to us. And as always, whatever your method of getting the show is, if you could go on and give us 5 stars, that would be just absolutely great, because that's what shows, you know, that people are listening, and it gives the show legs for other people to listen. And you know, as much as we just enjoy doing this, and I've never made any bones about it, I just enjoy talking to my buddies. But there is a certain sense of satisfaction of knowing it's getting out there and people are listening to it and people are getting any kind of pleasure out of our about our warbling on about different topics. So all that said, today is, as we said, a traditional episode. We picked 2 truly random books. This is as random of a book as I've picked in quite some time. Usually I kind of have an inkling of, well, I feel like picking something from this series or something like that. This time I just kind of like threw a dart, and where it landed, that's the book I did. And I ended up on Daredevil number 89, which has a cover date of July of 1972. It was released on April 4th of 72. Story was written by Jerry Conway. It was penciled by Gene Colan, inked by Tom Palmer, lettered by John Costanza, and edited by Stan Lee. The cover is by Sal Buscema, and it shows a bordered image upon some type of a hovercraft type thing with a window overlooking a cityscape. On board, Daredevil is at the center, and he's being zapped by Electro, shot by Kilgrave, and shot yet again by a thug. The story is titled Crisis. The splash page shows Daredevil swinging under a phallic-looking helicopter. He swings about as the thugs on board take shots at him, and the nameless flunkies whine about how their boss wants DD eliminated. But to their chagrin, he crashes in through a window, punches them out, and leaps clear before the chopper crashes into San Francisco Bay. Of course, the Expositional News Network reports that the henchmen were apprehended, so no one died in the crash. Kilgrave watches the report on the news with a blonde named Lucille at his side. The report goes on to discuss the unknown whereabouts of Electro, who fought DD back way back when in issue number 2, which gives Kilgrave an idea, and he sends an underling named Renault to find Electro and bring him back. Later at Lookout Point, we join the Black Widow with a dude named Danny, who's clumsily putting the moves on her and is quickly rejected. She swings away, full of angst and thoughts of love, and settles down for a good cry. Meanwhile, Matt Murdock is home and hanging with Ivan, the widow's chauffeur, bodyguard, surrogate father, and Matt gets a call offering him a job with a local powerhouse law firm. The widow arrives at home and wants to be left alone. We cut to a warehouse where Electro is zapping Kilgrave's man, but relents when he hears that it involves Daredevil. Back to the widow's mansion, where Matt and Ivan are discussing Natasha's activities. They believe she's trying to sleep, but what she's really doing is suiting up and swinging off. She's quickly followed by Daredevil, but their embrace is interrupted by Electro, who arrives on a hovercraft and attacks in a Gene Colan splash page. Daredevil leaves the widow to handle Electro while he leaves to take care of the man in the hovercraft. He enters and confronts Kilgrave, taking out his henchmen, and while battling them, he uses his billy club to smash gears controlling the controls of the hovercraft. While Kilgrave tries to get control, Daredevil makes a quick exit, followed by the crash of the hovercraft. And so we rejoin the widow, who's leaping about, eluding blasts from Electro, and she tricks him into focusing his energy into lightning rods, which somehow causes a feedback and knocks him silly, at which point our heroes are reunited and ponder the mysteries at hand. The end. This... I just hate that I sound like a broken record sometime. But this just had the seeds of something that could have been really cool, and it's just not. First of all, they dismiss Electro as a total mort. Electro should be so much more of a threat in the Marvel Universe than he ever is, and that always bothers me.
Right.
Because he should be, yeah, you know, like a Magneto-level power. And yet, you know,
I agree. I mean,
like, even Daredevil, you know, it's not even the writers are treating him like a mort. Now Daredevil is treating him like a mort. It's like, you take care of him, Widow. Like, he doesn't even have any concern over it. So, like, that bothers me a little bit. I just thought the way he's drawn is kind of strange. And it looks to me like Colan may have been planning to make this the Jester instead of Electro, from the way his hood or cowl looks. It does not look like Electro at all to me as far as that goes. It almost looks like the lightning bolts on his headdress are kind of an afterthought. Just feels like it should have been more. There should have been more to this. There should have been more of a battle. This is, we're again sounding like a broken record. We complain about decompressed. We complain about overly compressed. This is overly compressed. This should have been like a 3-issue thing, and both villains should have posed a much bigger threat and been much more difficult to dispose of than they were. The actual disposal, it takes no effort at all.
Right.
So that's my disappointment with this one. I think Jerry Conway, and I know this came up recently in a conversation, at this point, you know, he was a fairly young guy. I think he might have been in his late teens at this point. And I don't think he fully grasped Daredevil as a hero and his power set as compared to other costumed heroes, because he didn't seem to really play up the fact that he knows everything that's around him and about him, and that he would be fully aware that the Black Widow was not asleep at all time, you know, that she's in the same building. You know, he would hear her, that her heart is not at rest, that she's awake and up. He probably would also sense that she's lying when she's telling him everything's okay, but on the other hand, she's got the ability probably to fake something like that. So I'll give that one away. But you know, he should certainly be aware that she's up and about and moving around without having to take any real measures to see that. What'd you think?
Well, I kind of dig the cover, and I really like the interior art. It's funny because I have no idea what issue it is, but I remember as a kid, I either had, maybe both, I'm not sure. I was going to say, I either had a coverless issue of Daredevil from the Gene Colan era, or I thumbed through an issue on the stands from the Colan era. And I remember it was Colan specifically, it was a Daredevil title. I could not tell you what issue it was. And I remember just absolutely hating the art. Like, oh my God, this guy can't draw. And it wasn't until Phantom Zone, the DC Phantom Zone series, that completely turned my mind around about Gene Colan. Now he is absolutely one of my favorite comic book artists. But it took that to get me to linger over it long enough to start to appreciate. And I really like this, but the art is definitely the strong point of this issue. I really hope this doesn't come off as a harsh criticism, because I really, really, really like and respect Jerry Conway very much. But the writing in this was awful. I'm not sure what he was going for, but it feels like the worst eccentricities of both Stan Lee and Roy Thomas put together. The dialogue is clunky, it's wordy, it's goofy. I'm aware in the very broad strokes of this era of Daredevil without having really read much of any of it. I think my total awareness as far as issues I've read of this are issues that you've brought to the show that I've been on those episodes, and that's about it. So, you know, I knew that at one time he and Natasha had a thing, but that was about it. So I had a lot of questions, which I'm not going to bother to go into, you know, in for the purposes of this episode, but it just, I felt like it could have done a little bit better job of maybe hand-holding for newbies jumping in at this point, because Kilgrave seems really weird to me. This must be early Kilgrave, I guess, because he, other than having the name and being colored all purple, he doesn't seem anything like the Kilgrave that I would know from much later on. Now, I don't know this character very much, but I remember him from, like, Power Man and Iron Fist, I think. And then I think I first met him in one of the Marvel team-up annuals, which I think was with Power Man, now that I think about it. I think it was Power Man, Iron Fist, Daredevil, and maybe one other character. I can't remember. Maybe Moon Knight?
That sounds right.
And he had a completely different look. He almost looked like a purple Joker. But I remember him, he had the power of, you know, any command he gave to anybody, they just automatically had to do it. And I couldn't quite get a grasp on that with this, if he has that power yet, or if people are just obeying him because he's in charge. I couldn't quite get that.
No, that is his power at this point.
Okay.
I think, and I'm trying to remember, I think when he was first introduced, he was a little bit more simple, whereas here he's a little bit more plotting and maniacal. But you got to remember, this is also, you know, the Comics Code Authority. They couldn't go quite as far with him as they later could go.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
what they did, you know, later on, and what they actually did in the Jessica Jones TV series is really showing you how, you know, how that kind of power could be abused.
Right.
And I think, you know, that really put it at play. But in this, you know, you gotta deal with the fact that the Code Authority was gonna, you know, not going to approve anything too vicious. So it's really just, you know, they do what he says, and, you know, what he says isn't all that vicious or maniacal. But we'll get there.
he came off as just another almost like cross between like a super villain and like a mob boss, almost like a Bond villain kind of thing. I mean, he seemed like he would be completely interchangeable with the Owl or Hammerhead or somebody like that. You know, he didn't seem like, even though he has his shtick, he didn't seem like it was really differentiating him. It was like you could almost plug in any other gangster type supervillain into this issue and still have the same type of story, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, totally. I don't think they really exploit his power set in this particular issue. And they could have certainly done more with that.
And Electro was kind of the big surprise, but also, as you say, the big disappointment in this, because I completely agree with you. I think that Spider-Man, I mean, I think most people already agree that Spider-Man has the coolest rogues gallery in comics, But even with him having the coolest rogues gallery, he also has a rogues gallery, I think, full of potentially really awesome characters that tend to get treated as morts. And Electro might be right near the top of that list because, as you say, this guy should be a serious, serious threat. And I think every once in a while he has been portrayed accurately that way as kind of... I like him where he's portrayed as he is a serious threat, yet he's not so bright, so he's kind of easily defeated, and he himself is not living up to his true potential type of thing. That's cool. I can work with that. But when the writer is purposely treating him as, oh, he's just kind of a mort, and not... exploiting the character's true potential, you know, up to that point, then I don't know. It tends to annoy me a bit. And that was kind of him in this, because, yeah, he doesn't seem like he's a very serious threat, and he's easily bested by, I mean, Black Widow, of all people. So
he's not even really bested by Black Widow. He's just outmaneuvered.
Right, yeah.
She doesn't actually, like, engage him in battle.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, didn't they try several different looks for Electro over time before basically going back to his classic look?
They did.
Is that what's going on here?
But I don't think this is one of them. Like I said, I think they... I look at the way the mask is drawn here, and it looks like the Jester's mask.
Right.
So that's for some reason that's what comes to mind for me. It almost looks like, yeah, I guess it could have been an effort to give him a new look, but it just feels so similar to that I'm wondering if it wasn't, you know, we're going to do something and then all of a sudden they decide, okay, we'll add in all this electric power, you know, lines and stuff, and that'll be what we're doing. I'm not sure.
It's just weird that he has his classic look on the cover, but then this goofy new look inside.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't like it. I really don't like it at all. It just looks really weird.
As much as the classic look is probably not very realistic, it is a classic look, and I'm perfectly content for them to just stick with that all the time.
Right. Yeah, me too.
I don't really
I'll look him up on Mike's Amazing World real quick to see, is there an index for Electro? Because I know he does that with certain characters. No, he does not. Not with Electro. Well, shit. Because I'm curious, is this the first time, and maybe the last time, Electro had this particular look? Like, was this Cullen trying to change him up? You know, because Neil Adams would do that. You know, Neil Adams, I think probably arguably the most famous one is when he did it with Green Arrow in Brave and the Bold. You know, he had Batman and Green Arrow team up. Green Arrow had a completely different look, and it stuck. And that became his new look. And I'm kind of wondering, is that what Cullen's going for here, is maybe trying to change his look a little bit? And then I'm curious, you know, did it stick for any length of time, or was this kind of a one-and-done costume similar to Supergirl's constant costume changes for a time over an adventure where they were trying to give her a new look, too, and none of them really stuck?
See, that doesn't really work for me either, though, because if they were taking him and saying, you know what, he's become kind of a mort, we want to reinvigorate the character, we're going to give him a new costume and make him into a more viable threat than before, I'm good with that. But for them to just we're going to give him a new costume and then we're going to have him disposed of with no effort whatsoever, that makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's see, this was Daredevil 89. So he appeared two issues prior to this in Daredevil 87. I wonder what the costume looks like in that one.
Oh, I don't
know. If it's this one or not.
That I didn't do that level of research. I knew he was in the second issue. And just by the way, as an update for my Daredevil collection, if you recall, I had decided I was going to make my collection issues 1 through 200 was my target. I wasn't going for anything over 200. I now have all but three. I don't have issue 1, I don't have issue 2, and I don't have issue 16. I have everything else in that run.
Nice.
Yeah, and I, you know, I didn't break the bank on any of them. I mean, I, you know, a couple of them I spent more than, you know, it's not like I got them in the dollar bin, but not crazy money on anything. I think the most I spent was like maybe issue 3 or issue 7. Probably issue 7 was the most, and I think I got that for like 60.
Nice.
Because issue 7 is the first red costume, and it's him against Namor. It's a pretty famous issue. So
in Daredevil 87, he does have this costume. So prior to that, he appeared in Amazing Spider-Man number 82. So let's see.
And I'm pretty sure that's Spider-Man the classic 82. Costume. If I remember,
yep,
that
is
the classic.
So yes, so it looks like Colin was trying to reinvent him in Daredevil. All right, so now let's go forward. He next appears after this story in Omega the Unknown number 2. Let's see. Do I have... Oh, I do. Okay. Let's see here. What's he look like in... Oh, my God. The art is horrible in this book. Who is this?
Jim Mooney?
You know, I typically like Jim Mooney, but
is
I
it?
Don't
was,
like
was my,
yeah.
Was my guess correct?
Yeah. Yep, it's Jim Mooney. Oh, I thought you had it pulled up. That was good. That was excellent.
I did not have it pulled up. I was taking a stab at my very quickly fading memories.
Well, that's weird. Wait a minute. Let me pull this back up again. I'm looking at... the hell is this? The Complete Marvel Reading Order is the website. It's, CMRO. The Complete Marvel Reading, and they have chronologies of different characters. So it says that Electro's next, Omega the Unknown, Volume 1, Number 2. And is that not the issue I'm looking at? Number 2. And where the hell's Electro? Oh, there he is. At the very end of the story, he comes in. Okay. And he's back in the classic look. So, yes, it did not, apparently, it did not go beyond these two issues. So yeah, it was. It looks like it was a. Well, let's see. He's in Omega the Unknown 2 and 3. Let's check one more book. Marvel Team Up number 56 here. Let's see. Marvel Team Up number 56 was another Daredevil story. Oh, I remember this one from when I was a kid. Oh, this is a nice one. Sal Buscema and Dave Hunt on the art. Opens up with Daredevil facing off with, what was this dude's name? Polar, Icicle, something like that?
Jack Frost?
Is it Jack? I don't know. He's got a blue costume with like icy...
Well, he was Jack Frost originally when he was introduced, then he became Blizzard.
Blizzard! That's it. That's it. Named after a Dairy Queen treat, poor guy. And Electro is back in the classic. Okay, so it only lasts these two issues then of Daredevil, this ugly... Actually, the costume's really not all that different. It's really the headdress.
Yeah.
But
well, there's a little bit around the shoulders, I think, is a little different, too, but
yeah.
Nothing too dramatic. That's just a tweak.
Yeah.
The headdress is what's very different and not very good as far as I'm concerned.
I noticed, too, that he has lightning bolts coming off of his ankles, very similar to, like, Namor's wings. Does he have that in his regular costume? Because I don't think he does.
Not that I can recall, no.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, costume aside, I do think Gene Colan brought it in this. And then, you know, being inked by Tom Palmer never hurts.
Nope.
You know, I think the art in this is very good. But as you... alluded to, I don't think this is the kind of art that a young kid would enjoy. As good as it is, I think it takes a more sophisticated eye to be comfortable with it.
Right. Because, you know, it's very different from the other comic art of the time, which I think was what, you know, that was my reaction as a kid, was just looking at this and going, this guy can't draw. But well, actually, he can draw masterfully. It's just he has a very different art style that didn't look like the other superheroes of the time. And I don't know whether fair or unfair, I think that would, as you say, make a young person looking at this draw unfair comparisons with, you know, those other heroes that, you know, like say Batman or somebody like that. Although, you know, eventually Colin would do Batman as well, but I don't know. But I really dig it now, but I definitely did not back then. It was one of the reasons, you know, one of many reasons I just never got into Daredevil. The other thing too with this is, I don't know, this to me is one of those prime examples of Daredevil not standing out. He doesn't, please feel free to disagree with me, but he just doesn't seem unique enough in this. Like, if you were to take just this one issue as an example, he's discount Batman. He's swinging around on a rope and, you know, doing all kinds of acrobatic stuff, and he's quipping a lot. He's almost like putting Batman and Spider-Man together in certain respects, you know, with the quipping, although not as much of the jokey, but just he's very wordy, you know, just talking through all the battles and it's just really weird because, you know, I guess I'm just forward projecting, but, you know, I'm more used to him being a little more lean and mean, you know, the Frank Miller version, that sort of thing. Not necessarily, he doesn't necessarily need to be darker, but it's just the jokey, quipping Daredevil just is weird to me, and it's never really worked for me. And I dare say, at least in this particular issue, Conway practically ignores the whole blindness thing, and you touched on that as well. You know, I'm looking, you know, thumbing back and forth through the issue, and I don't see a single panel in this that illustrates him using his radar sense,
yeah,
which is probably his greatest gimmick. So he really does just kind of come off as Marvel discount Batman in a lot of ways. And that, I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of this character to begin with, but that really sells him short when he has really just the one gimmick and isn't even using that to differentiate himself from any other thing that's on the stands at this time. So I don't know. I loved the art, but that was about it. It really was kind of like, yeah, that was okay. Plus, I'm not really a big fan of Black Widow to begin with, but especially from this era, I never liked this look for her. And she seems really out of character to me, with, you know, just being weepy, morose, you know, fawning female. And I don't know, am I wrong in that, or do I just not know enough about the character? Because it just seemed really odd to me. I don't think of her that way. She's, you know, she's more the cold spy, and yeah. I don't get any of that from her in this. She's more like Catwoman or something in this.
No, I agree. I don't see her. I agree on so many levels with what you just said, so I can just kind of address it all. You know, I mentioned with Daredevil that it doesn't seem like Conway really had a grasp on the character and his power set and his personality even. You know, Daredevil was an interesting thing, and Dave Weider would probably be the best guy to talk about this, but he, you know, his history seemed to say that they didn't exactly know where to go with him. They came up with this cool concept for the character, but they kept changing, you know, do they want him to be like Spider-Man? Do they want him to be, you know, kind of brooding and you know, more Batman-y? You know, what do we want with him? And I think, you know, this whole radar sense thing, you know, made him a somewhat unique character, and yet a lot of the writers failed to exploit that. You know, ultimately, I think Frank Miller did a really good job with it, but then, much like Batman, Daredevil became a victim, I think, of Frank Miller follow-up, where the people who followed him tried to do the same thing he did, or they tried to even take it further. And that really didn't do the character any good. It just kind of mired him deeper and deeper into a set of stories that were not quite as good as what Miller had done. You know, some and that's with varying degrees of success. Some of the writers had some very good stories in there. Some writers had very good storylines. You know, I know a lot of people are very high on what Brubaker did with the character. But I think at this point, they didn't know whether to make him, you know, film noir or superhero. And
right.
I think they were trying to lean towards superhero. And then shortly after this, you know, Steve Gerber takes over and it's like superhero, you know, with a side of LSD. so, you know, there's a lot that bears examination, you know, in this character's history. And this isn't the strongest of the stories by any means, but you know, the art kind of carries the book.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. If this had been, you know, like Frank Springer or something, I would have had an awful time getting through it. But yeah, the book, you know, the art definitely carries it and carried me through. The art kept me turning pages because it is beautiful. But that's about all it really had going for it, I'll be honest. I was glad to see that we're well beyond the, what was his goofy assumed brother identity that he was doing?
Mike Murdock.
I was really hoping that this wasn't going to be one of those stories, and it's not, so it looks like we're beyond that era at this point. So that was nice.
They got past that quite a while before this. I think it was in the 40s or something where they did the you know, Mike Murdock died storyline.
What a shame.
Yeah, we'll miss him.
Yeah, this was all right. I mean, I, you know, a week from now, I'm going to forget that I ever read it. So.
Yeah, I'm sure. So to rate this one, I like the cover. I think it's pretty cool. I think Daredevil, you know, should be absolutely dead at this point since he's getting zapped with electricity and shot twice. Although the thug may miss him, but there's no question Killraven got him. In the back, but it's still pretty well drawn. I like it, and I also like the fact that, you know, it bears a little closer inspection. That if you're looking, you could actually see that this hydrofoil or whatever it is that they're on is tilted, that it's sideways, and that it's, you know, probably crashing. So I think that just adds a little element to it, or a little detail. So I think it's pretty cool. It's not iconic by any stretch, but it's, in a week from now, I'll probably forget it. But I'm going to say a B. I think it's pretty cool. The interior art, I think, is really solid. The only quibble I have is the headdress on Electro. And I don't know if that's Colin's doing or if that's something management did. I don't like the headdress, but it's not badly drawn. So I'm going to say an A on the art. I think it's pretty solid. It's got some good detail. Even things, you know, like the trolley, because they're in San Francisco and things like that. The story, it's just a throwaway story. It was entertaining enough to read. It didn't feel like a slog. But it's, you know, as you said, a week from now it'll be forgotten. So it didn't have anything really special going for it, so I'm going to just say a C on the story. It was acceptable, but it was nothing special. And overall, because of the strength of the artwork, I'm going to give the book a B.
I think I'm pretty close to you on all those regards. I really like this cover. I don't recall ever having laid eyes on it before, but yeah, it's really sharp. I think it's a very, very cool cover. Although it's doing that, I forget what you call it, but this particular trade dress, we've talked about this a million times, where it's kind of the window in the art type of thing.
Yeah.
Even though neither you or I are really fans of that, at least with this one, it does kind of work, because Daredevil, because I think at the top of the panel border, his and Electro's hands are actually breaking the border, it does give a slight 3D effect to the overall image so that you can actually imagine that Daredevil's foot that's kicking out after having, you know, kicked the bad guy actually looks like it's coming right at you, the reader. So it does have a nice 3D type effect to it that really is kind of neat. I love the coloring on this. I love when Daredevil's costume is colored just right so it really has that satiny red look to it, and it does here. It looks really nice. So yeah, I like the cover. It really pops. I will say a B plus on the cover. I think it's pretty sharp. Interior art, I mean, I am such a mark for both Gene Colan and Tom Palmer. You put these guys together, I'm just in hog heaven. So I mean, it's just a beautiful book to look at. I think I was going to go a little lower on the art. I was going to say like an A minus, but actually, as I flip back and forth through it, I think it's really nice. I really don't have any qualms with it, other than maybe a little bit with the coloring, but that's not on either of the artists. So yeah, I think I will give it a straight up A on the art as well. It's really beautiful to look at, and then the story was just kind of there. I didn't think it was necessarily bad. But I wasn't sucked in. This is definitely not one of those where I'm like, okay, you got me. I want to see what's going to happen next issue. I really don't care. So it's just kind of meh. I'm going to say C, right middle of the road. It was just, eh, it was a comic. I read it, and a week from now, I've forgotten I ever read it. That was kind of a shame because we have looked at other issues of Daredevil, with this art team that I was like, damn, that was fantastic. The one where he battled Mr. Hyde and they were plummeting out the window. I loved that. I thought that was great. And it started to kind of change my opinion of Daredevil a little bit. But then reading this, I'm like, nope, this is what I thought Daredevil was. So, again, right back to not really being interested. So overall grade, I agree with you. I mean, this is really, it's for the art. If you like Gene Colan, then I would say, this is like a B book because of the Gene Colan. If you're not really up for Gene Colan, then it's probably more of a C book. So for me, I'll give it a B because I really did like the art in it. So yeah, that's right. About it.
So that covers Daredevil. What'd you bring?
So this one's an interesting one. So, as you know, I'm doing several read-through projects all at once, just, kind of floating all over the comic spectrum. And this one came up in my read-through of reading DC in the 80s with the purpose of reading every single DC title published between the first appearance, the first pre-Crisis Monitor appearance, right through the Crisis on Infinite Earths. And I'm reading all of them specifically looking for other pre-Crisis Monitor appearances that maybe have never been documented anywhere. I just want to make sure I'm being thorough and I have them all. So that came up during this reading. And this particular book is Weird War Tales number 123. This is actually the penultimate issue of the series, which I didn't realize at the time when I was reading it, but later on when I looked it up to get the date information and all of that sort of thing, that's when I realized, oh, this is the next to last issue. Now, normally I would not cover a war book without our buddy David A. Pascarella, but rest easy, Dave, if you're listening to this, because this really isn't a war book in that regard, or at least this particular story isn't. So again, Weird War Tales number 123. This is the May 1983 cover dated issue. Is actually on sale on the stands, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, on February 23rd, 1983, for a cover price of a mere 60 cents. Cover is by Joe Kubert. It's depicting a young woman reading about the hero of our story as he's locked in mortal combat with a fearsome looking, militarily garbed gorilla. The cover copy reads, "Only one man could save Earth from alien conquest, but he's dead. And that leaves it all up to this woman." Our story is entitled Captain Spaceman Will Be Waiting. It was written by Dan Mishkin and Derry Cohn. At least I assume that's how that guy's name is pronounced. It's C-O-H-N. I've never known how to pronounce his last name, but I think it's Cohn. They are the eventual co-creators of The Blue Devil a while from now. With art on this book, or in this story rather, by Rich Buckler and Frank Giacoya. So that's why this book is actually on my want list. I still have not scored a copy of this particular book yet, but I was trying to remember why was this one on my want list? And it's because of the Rich Buckler art, which I rather like, by the way. Anyway, here's our synopsis on this. So our story opens with Jean Farrell, newswoman for Channel 12 News, closing out the evening's broadcast with the sad report that the police have confirmed the body of an elderly man found in a rundown East Side hotel was that of 66-year-old Harry Dodge, one-time television star of the 1950s as the character Captain Spaceman, who ended each program with the words, "Wherever danger lurks, wherever the forces of galactic evil challenge the power of good, Captain Spaceman will be waiting." Jean signs off and complains to her producer about the inane nature of the filler material she just read, but the producer tells her that he liked it and wants a follow-up story for tomorrow. He orders her to go to the hotel where Dodge lived and get the story of the last years of Captain Spaceman. Reluctantly, Jean complies, and upon arrival at Dodge's building is sidelined by fellow tenant Roy Krepps, a Captain Spaceman fan, who shows Jean and her cameraman his vast collection of memorabilia, including his membership certificate to the Captain Spaceman Rocket Ranger Society, and informs them that the good captain did not die like they said. He, according to Krepps, was killed by an alien gorilla guy. Krepps even shows them a sketch of the supposed killer. The visit is cut short due to Jean's boss needing her cameraman, and they leave, Jean thinking to herself that Krepps is a loony. Back at the station, Jean rejoins her producer just in time to witness a live feed bulletin coming in from a fellow reporter that the Earth is under siege by hostile aliens. Central Park in New York City, the Eiffel Tower in Paris, the Colosseum in Rome, and perhaps a dozen other major cities all over the globe suffer devastating attacks and destruction at the hands of the alien menace. The image changes to show the face and demands of the alien invaders, and Jean, recognizing the visions from Krepp's sketch, quickly realizes she must go on the air immediately. Minutes later, Jean appears on TVs all over with the following message: "The true story of the invasion of Earth will be hard for many of you to believe, because it is also the true story of the death of someone most of you have long since forgotten, Captain Spaceman. The invaders say we are defenseless, and they are right, because they have slain Earth's greatest defender. Alone and unrecognized, Captain Spaceman died to save us all. And with him, perhaps, died our final hope. But if there are those who still believe in what Captain Spaceman was and what he stood for, all may not be lost." There is a secret place called childhood, the narration box tells us, a place filled with fantasy and innocence and, most of all, belief. We live inside that secret place until we grow too big and must tuck its mysteries away. But if we are wise, we hide that secret place somewhere near at hand. And we are treated to scenes from all over of men, everyday men, going to their secret drawers, that pocket in their briefcase, that old trunk, and picking out their Captain Spaceman decoder rings, their Captain Spaceman Rocket Ranger badges, their Captain Spaceman Rocket Ranger ray guns, donning their Captain Spaceman space helmets, when suddenly, on screen, appears the captain himself with the message, "I've taken over the airways, Rocket Rangers, so that we can prepare to rendezvous. Earth is in danger, and only we can save it." The army, helpless before the alien onslaught, is stunned to look up and see a legion of men, garbed in the distinctive colors and uniform of the Rocket Rangers, rushing to the rescue. "The power of belief," continues the narration box, "lies dormant in all of us, waiting for its moment. For most, it is only a feeble ember, but for a precious few, innocence is a flame that never dies. And someday, the chance will come to answer a special call, to fight a noble fight, and to discover the triumph of faith." The Rocket Rangers rout the aliens and send them scurrying away, defeated. Jean Farrell's next broadcast says, "In cities around the world today, at the same moment, an event occurred that some are calling a miracle. While skeptics have already suggested a variety of more quote-unquote logical explanations, a hoax, mass illusion, sunspots, this reporter begs to differ and to submit a much simpler answer. I now believe that whenever the power of good is threatened by galactic evil, Captain Spaceman will be waiting. The story closes out with a dedication ribbon that reads, "For Al Hodge, Captain Video." So, what really struck me with this story, and the reason that I wanted to cover it, was I think this, while I was kind of touched by the dedication at the end of this, which I'll get into in a second, this, I think, is a wonderful example of something that we totally take for granted today, is the wonders of the age that we live in, where 2 seconds in Google can give you a completely different perspective on something, you know, a story like this, because it makes me wonder how many comics, for example, have I read in my lifetime that had a reference that I just didn't get, but because the internet hadn't come along yet, I really had no way to like look into it, to look it up, to figure out what is this character talking about or what is this reference that I'm not getting. But now, because of, you know, the age that we're living in, you can do that. So when I got to the end of this story, I looked up Al Hodge, and it was, I don't know, it really kind of touched me when I realized that, oh my gosh, I guess Captain Video was a real thing, because my touchstone with Captain Video, my total sum exposure to Captain Video was in a Honeymooners episode where Ralph Cramden and Ed Norton go in together on buying a television, and the television set gets set up in Ralph's apartment. In the middle of the night, while Ralph's trying to sleep, Ed Norton comes down and is watching Captain Video, and he dons the Captain Video headset. And you must know this episode, right, Paul?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Space Helmet Auto, but, Captain Video.
Yeah.
Calling all Space Rangers, it's time to blast off with Captain Video and his Video Rangers.
Hello out there, Rangers. This is Captain Video. Are you all ready to join me today in our trip to outer space?
I am ready, Captain Video.
Very good. Let us all put on our official Captain Video space helmets. Adjust disintegrator guns.
Disintegrator gun adjusted, oh, Captain Video.
And now we blast off for Pluto and the moon. Attention, Rangers. I want all you Rangers at home to recite the Captain Video Ranger pledge.
I, Edward Norton, Ranger, third class in the Captain Video Space Academy, do solemnly pledge to obey my mommy and daddy, be kind to dumb animals and old ladies in and out of space, not to tease my little brothers and sisters, and to brush my teeth twice a day and drink milk after every meal.
All right, that's it. All right, out! Get out! Now look, you, let's have an understanding. We've had this set for 3 nights. And for 3 nights, I've listened to nothing but space shows, westerns, cartoon frolics, and puppet shows. Tonight, I am watching a movie. And if you dare to make a sound while a movie is on, I'll cut off your ass supply.
But I guess I never realized that, like, Captain Video was, like, that was a real thing, you know, that he was actually a real TV phenomenon at the time and everything. So you know, I looked up, you know, did a Google search, and there's a whole Wikipedia entry on Al Hodge. And it was kind of a sad story. It's kind of a familiar story, you know, similar to, say, like Adam West or, you know, certain other characters that, you know, become extremely famous for, you know, doing a character. George Reeves, another good example, you know, that, and then they become typecast. So then they can't really get into anything else because they're just, they're known for being that one thing, and that just kind of becomes their life. And that was definitely the case with him. And so this this story had a real basis in reality, as far as the, you know, the character and the adoration, and, you know, there being an entire generation that remembered this character, but then over time he'd kind of become just kind of forgotten. And I don't know, there was just something about that really touched me. And I wonder, you know, what do you think of this particular story?
I enjoyed it. I got a kick out of it. And I think, you know, this is an exceptionally short story. I think it's like 12 pages or something like that. And I think it's the perfect length, because it feels like it just gives you exactly what you need. It doesn't linger on anything too long. It doesn't rush by anything that you need. You know, it just gives you just enough to give that feeling. It reminded me a lot of the Twilight Zone episode Kick the Can, because that's one where it's like, you know, if you remember that episode, they're in a senior citizen home, and the one guy wants to play Kick the Can, which is a game that they played in their childhood, and ultimately when they do it, it kind of renews their youth and they become young again, whereas the one guy who doesn't want to do it then regrets that he didn't, and he feels bad, and he's like, please take me with you, and they're like, I'm sorry, we can't, because he didn't embrace it when he could. Anyway, like, that's the kind of thing that it brought to mind for me, just that feeling of don't close the door to your childhood, don't leave those childhood feelings behind, embrace them, you know. And I think as comic collectors, we do that, you know, on a regular basis. But it's just, you know, it had a certain warmth to it that could have been schmaltzy, and I don't think it was. I think it really just kind of embraced itself, and I embraced it in turn. I got a kick out of it. I'm surprised to say this, because you and I have had our debates on it, but I'm not so crazy about the Joe Kubert cover. Usually I'm the defender of Joe Kubert between the two of us. I like the way the woman is drawn. I don't like the way the Captain Video character is drawn. I think he's far too scratchy. He needs a little bit more just clarity to the way he's drawn. And I don't think it does justice to what we get in this issue. I do like the ape's face, though. I think that looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
The interior art, I think Rich Buckley did a nice job with it. And you're going to really cringe at this thought, but it almost has a feeling like a Frank Robbins type artwork to me.
No, I agree. I actually had the same thought when I first opened it up. I actually was kind of surprised to see it was Frank Giacoya, because I thought it was Frank Robbins at first. That's really funny you say that.
Well, it's kind of just the way it's, you know, I think the way the breakdowns are, not so much the inking, you know, the body language and such. But Rich Buckler, as we've discussed in the past, and, you know, he's a favorite of both of ours. But he did have a certain chameleon-like ability to make his artwork look like whatever style he wanted to go with. In his own way, it's almost like Rich Buckley didn't have his own style, because he was just a blend of everybody. And he could pretty much do what he wanted with it, but, you know, it was often just morphing from one look to another. And I think this particular style fits this story very well. It has a fantasy feel, but it also has kind of that old-timey feel. You know, Frank Robbins, I always said, was much better suited to be around in the Golden Age, you know, and that's why I like his artwork on things like The Invaders, where it's a Golden Age story. And I kind of feel like this story would fit that as well. So I do like the stylistic choices that Buckler made here. One of the things that just jumped out at me was on page two, I guess he's the station manager. Looks to me like Harold Ramis from Ghostbusters.
Yes, he does.
I wouldn't be at all surprised if he's actually fashioned after him. The guy who, you know, shows them the apartment, he looks just crazy enough so that she would be dismissive of what he says until she has that epiphany that it, you know, that it was real. That leap may be a little too fast. Like I don't understand making that leap, but it still worked fine for me. I don't think they needed to put a heck of a lot more on there.
What, making the leap that he was telling the truth, you mean?
Yeah, and that she should go on the air and tell everybody to embrace their childhood, basically.
I think it was just that, you know, Krepp showed them the picture, you know, the sketch that he claimed was the real killer of Captain Spaceman, and then it turns out that it's the spitting image of the alien, I guess it's the leader, you know, the leader of the invasion anyway, who's on TV making demands. She puts it together that oh my God, Krepps was telling the truth. The whole thing about then going on the air and telling everybody, you know, that they had to believe, I guess that's the last thing that Krepps says to them before he's kind of cut off and they leave is where he says, you know, Captain Spaceman said that if we believed in him, and then he's kind of cut off, so he doesn't get to finish his thought. Mm. But I guess it was enough to plant the idea in her head. I don't know. As you say, the story is greatly condensed because it is all, it's actually eight pages total, so it's very short. And I think it suffers in that aspect only in the aspect of, okay, so, you know, she asks everybody to believe, and you know, and they go and they pull out their, you know, their badges and their ray guns and their rings and, you know, all the memorabilia. But that doesn't quite explain the captain himself returning to kind of lead the forces. But all that aside, because I found the story just really touching and just, you know, it's heart's in the right place, I forgive all of that because this is meant to be that sort of a Twilight Zone-y type of title. Where you can forgive it in something like this, where I'd probably be totally unforgiving if this was, you know, just the regular issue of, you know, Superman or something. You know, I'd be a lot more critical of it. But
right.
I don't know. It just had such charm to me that it pretty much gets away with, you know, with that silliness.
Or, I think that's the exact word. I think it's charming.
Yeah, it is very charming. Well, good. I'm glad you took it that way because I really wasn't sure what you know, you guys might think of it. But yeah, I thought it was really touching. I like the whole aspect of, you know, the people that we see. You know, one of the guys looks like he's a bartender. One of the guys looks like he's some sort of a businessman or something. And then this other guy just looks like, you know, it looks like he's home with his wife. You know, just the whole thing of, you know, this being just common everyday people, yet they've kind of closeted their childhood love of Captain Spaceman away, but it's still, you know, where they can go and access it. You know, they pull out the rings, they pull out the badges and the ray guns. I don't know, there's just something about that. I was kind of choked up by that. I was like, oh, that I can totally associate with that. You know, I can, you know, that strikes a chord with me type of thing.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm totally on board with you there. I think that's exactly the purpose of the story, and I think it lived up to it.
I noticed on Al Hodge's Wikipedia that there was the mention of the Honeymooners episode, but that was pretty much it. So hopefully it'll stay. Hopefully it'll stick. But I added, and last time I checked, it was still there. But I added, you know, just a footnote that, you know, that this story exists, you know, as a tribute to him, you know, and gave a, you know, a reference to the, you know, specific issue and everything. So hopefully that sticks with his Wikipedia. I've done precious little Wikipedia ever, but the few that I've ever done, it seems like they were pretty quickly taken away by whoever moderates that sort of thing, which is annoying, and the reason I haven't done more of it, but hopefully this one sticks for a while. So
yeah, I just opened up the page. I see the first story in DC Comics Weird World Wars, Weird War Tales, number 123, May 1983. Captain Spaceman Will Be Waiting is dedicated to Al Hodges. That's yep, what you, that's what you wrote?
Yep. Yeah, I wrote that.
Wow, you're famous.
Yep.
All right, so you want to rate this?
Yeah, I'd like to give it a rating. I really enjoyed this a lot. I'm with you on the cover. You know that I'm not, by any stretch of the imagination, a Joe Kubert fan. I am trying not to be so harsh and not to be so critical, but I've just, right from childhood, I have never liked this guy's art. It just does not appeal to me. I respect him and his place in comics history and everything. But I just don't see myself ever becoming a fan. I just don't like that scratchy art style. I think he's a hell of a layout guy. I just think his final product always looks off to me. I just don't like that whole scratchy thing. So cover-wise, here exists inside this issue such a wonderful, charming story that genuinely touched me. And I'd have never picked this issue up judging a book by its cover, because I just think the cover's kind of ugly, frankly. So I have to give the book, I'll say a C-. It just doesn't do anything for me. There's nothing wrong, per se. It's just not my aesthetic at all. And I don't think it... it really gives you any clue as to, you know, the story inside. So that's a shame. But the story inside, the art I really like. I'm not the biggest fan of Frank Giacoya as an inker, but overall this works pretty good. I actually get a very strong Dick Giordano vibe off of a lot of the art, with this team together, Buckler and Giacoya. I think together their two art styles kind of merge to make art that looks very reminiscent of Giordano to me. And there's nothing wrong with that. I thought Giordano was a hell of an artist. So, the coloring is okay. A lot of it's dark. A lot of some odd choices for some of the backgrounds and everything. But once we get to the big action sequence where the Rangers come in, I love how it's colored. The look of Captain Spaceman's costume is really cool and very striking. And I like the mix of colors with the Space Rangers and everything. That I think that stuff looks really good. And, some nice dynamic, hero shots by Buckler. Overall the art I really, really liked in this. I'm going to say a solid B on the art. I really enjoyed the art in this. And then the story, I'm going to give the story a straight up A. Yes, it's not the most logical story. Like, how the hell does Captain Spaceman come back to lead the troops if he's dead? But I can forgive all of that just for the pure charm of what the story was trying to do, which was, homaging Al Hodge, which obviously had to be some sort of a hero to the writers of this story. And I think that was a wonderful gesture. Overall for this, now this of course is just the first story in the book, but just judging, just strictly this first story and everything, I think overall great on this. I'm going to give it a straight up A. I really, really did enjoy it. I thought it was heartwarming.
All right, now I got to rip it to shreds. The cover, now I do like Kubert. There's something about him that's like comfort food for me. I'm not sure exactly what, but I like his traditional war drawings. I like his Tarzan drawings. While I like his stuff on Hawkman, I'm not too big on Kubert as a superhero science fiction artist. And that's what we have here. And I feel like because of that, is why I feel like it needs just some more clarity to the way it's drawn. I don't like the way Captain Spaceman's face is drawn. And that's probably my biggest criticism of it. But I just feel like the whole thing could just be just cleaned up a little bit and it would be a much better cover. I'm not crazy about the blue background. I feel like something else could have made it pop, and this coloring didn't. I'm going to give it a C. I don't think it's a bad cover. I don't think it's a particularly good cover. I think it's an average cover. The interior art, I'm much higher on. I do like that Frank Robbins feel that we get in here. I do feel it's very fitting for the story, but it's also cleaned up, you know, with the Rich Buckler style. I think it serves the story really well, and I'm going to say it's a solid B, bordering on B+ on the artwork. The story, while it may lack something as far as clarity as to why this happened, why that happened, I don't think that's what this particular story needed. I think this story is a pure out-and-out fantasy, and that's all it is, and that's all it tries to be. I don't think it tries to give you any logical reason for it to happen. I think the logical reason is the power we have to believe when we're children literally has power to it. I think that's the whole story, and I think if you try to say, well, scientifically, this is what happened, you just destroy that whole message anyway. So. Right. I think the story is absolutely charming, and it gave me the feels. So I'm gonna say an A, and I mean feels in a good way, not in a sexually perverted way. I'm gonna give the story a straight up A. It really made me feel good when it was over. I just enjoyed the fact that I read this. And overall, on a whole, I'm gonna say this is one where the story carries it so much that I'm going to give the book an A. Because the story is so good.
Well, good. I'm glad that you enjoyed this. I was a little nervous bringing this one. I really thought this might be one of those examples of, what are you, nuts? But good. I'm glad you liked it, too. I was sad to see, though, that it apparently has not ever been reprinted. And that's a shame. It should wind up in one of those like showcases or something, just so that more people can lay eyes on it. Because I did think it was really a nice little story. But yeah, that's all I got.
All right, and I guess that's all we have for today's show. I hope everybody enjoyed listening. And please remember what we talked about at the beginning. Send us some feedback. We'd really like to hear from you. In the meanwhile, we'll see you next week. Bye bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.